from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This week, Rob Dillard's series, Being Muslim in Iowa, has highlighted Iowa's rich Muslim history. It's a history that includes the establishment of the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids nearly 80 years ago. This hour, we'll explore Iowa's Muslim connections. We'll talk with Lisa Killinger, an Iowa woman who was raised Episcopalian and eventually converted to Islam. Also, Professor Mahmoud Hamid of Drake University and Miriam Amer, Executive Director of the Iowa Council of Islamic Relations. Are you a Muslim living in Iowa? Tell us your story. We'll get started right after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What do you know about the Islamic faith? A majority of Americans say they know very little about this major world religion, even though it's followed by 1.5 billion people around the globe. That's 5 times the number of people who live in the United States. A recent Pew Research poll showed 1/4 of Americans surveyed said they knew nothing at all about Islam. Muslims make up a small portion of Iowa's population. It's well below 1%. Even so, they enjoy a long, rich history in our state. It dates back to the 19th century. And all this week, Iowa Public Radio's Rob Dillard has introduced us to many facets in the series Being Muslim in Iowa. This hour, we want to cap that off and further explore Iowa's Muslim connections with a number of guests. But first, I'm joined by Rob Dillard to talk a little bit about the series. From the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines, Rob, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Remind us again about this Being in Iowa series. What are the groups we're looking at?
For the next year, we've been looking at them for the past 6 months. So it's an 18-month project. So it's an intensive look at some of the subgroups that make up Iowa's population. So far this year, I've looked at Latinos, military veterans, and most recently, Muslims in the state.
Of course, Islam, Muslim community, very much in the news. What are some of the elements you've investigated during this week-long series?
Well, I have to say, of the three I've produced so far, the most educational has been the one about the Muslims, because I am one of those Americans who knew very little about the faith going into this project. I knew about the Mother Mosque in Cedar Rapids, but I did not realize how rich and long-standing the history of Muslims in the state of Iowa, stretching back to the late 1800s. So that was an eye-opener for me. I knew about some of the food restrictions that Muslims face, but I didn't realize how complicated it is to follow a halal diet, one that's acceptable to Muslims, and how hard it is to ensure the animals that are slaughtered for food are done so in a humanitarian fashion. And so I went to a company in Cedar Rapids that specializes in halal food distribution and making sure that the food available for Muslims in the state and around the world is halal. I was fascinated to hear how converts to Islam explained the details of the faith and why they found it so appealing and willing to switch religions to follow Islam. I was also interested in the reasons Muslim women choose to wear or not wear a headscarf in public and whether they feel safe doing so in these highly politicized times. And then there was the intriguing story of El Cader and its connection to the Muslim world, the small town up in northeast Iowa.
And a number of those facets we'll explore in depth this hour as well. So it's interesting that you learned the most in this series so far. And for those who don't know, the Mother Mosque of America holds quite a place in history, doesn't it?
Absolutely so. And the families that I was able to meet in Cedar Rapids are longstanding, highly involved in the community, deeply involved in the business scene in Cedar Rapids, and they, as I said, have been there since the 1880s.
Rob Dillard, thank you very much for this series. A wonderful job on it, as certainly we expected. The next, give us a preview on the next Being in Iowa series?
We're going to look at African Americans in the state, and another small group about 70, 80,000 of them in Iowa. We'll take a look at education, health care, politics, a whole raft of issues that we'll explore with African Americans. That's scheduled for the last week of September.
Iowa Public Radio's Rob Dillard. And Rob, thank you very much. We want to remind our listeners you can hear all of Rob Dillard's reports on being Muslim in Iowa, being Latino, being a veteran in Iowa in this series at iowapublicradio.org. Plenty of podcasts available for you there. Thanks, Rob.
I'm Ben.
And we want to explore a little bit more during this hour and invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation, especially if you're a Muslim living in Iowa. Tell us your story. How did you get here? Perhaps you grew up here. Do you have a question about Islam or what it's like to be Muslim in Iowa? 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or give us a tweet at IPR Talk. Joining me now, Mahmoud Hamid, Associate Professor of Politics at Drake University, also in our Des Moines studio. And that name should be familiar because he's, of course, one of the political scientists you hear on Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. Professor Hamid, Mahmoud, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You joined the politics department at Drake University in the fall of 2008. I was reading your bio. You're twice a Fulbright scholar. And even though you received your PhD from the University of Utah, you got your BA and your MA in political science from Cairo University in Egypt. Now, as a Muslim who came from Egypt to live in the United States, to live in Iowa, tell us your perspective on what it means to be Muslim in Iowa.
Wow, highly interesting. I'll give you a brief story. After finishing my PhD in 08, back in 08, I had offers to go and join other programs in other parts of the country. And part of the rationale for me and my family to come to Des Moines is the having an established Muslim community in Iowa. But most importantly for us was having good schools and having a community that is welcoming of different ethnicities and different religions. So that was part of the rationale for why we came here, other than going to other universities in other parts of the country. And I think we have, my wife and myself and my kids agree that we have made a good choice. Mm-hmm. We live in Clive. Our neighbors are fantastic. We have no problems integrating. My kids go to school. We have no problems because of our ethnicity or our religion. So I think that is how most Muslims feel in Iowa. And while Iowa is not one of the largest states that have Muslim representations, Iowa is actually not one of the largest 10 states with the Muslim population. California, Texas, Illinois, Ohio, and New Jersey are. I think the Muslims in Iowa are growing, and we have a very interesting Muslim community here. We have, as Rob and you indicated, an established Muslim community that dates back more than 100 years. Mm-hmm. But we also have young, recent immigrants.
In the Des Moines area, approximately, do you know how many Muslims live in the community?
That's another interesting question. And it's interesting because of a couple of factors. First, the definition of being a Muslim is not entirely clear. Is a Muslim someone who just identifies with Islam as a religion, but does not practice at all? So he or she does not come to the mosque or the Islamic center, or does not pray. So there's fluctuation in this. And again, also because there is a whole range of Muslims who came to Iowa recently. The number is hard to measure scientifically. We have waves of immigrants from Iraq, from Bosnia, and from Somalia. So it's hard to put a realistic number on it. But I think we have doubled in number in the last decade or so.
Mahmoud Hamid, thank you very much. Please stay put there. We'll certainly want to come back to you. Also joining our conversation, Miriam Amer, Executive Director of the Iowa Council of Islamic Relations, joining us by phone. Miriam, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me.
I understand you direct the Muslim American Society's Freedom Iowa chapter. Before we get to some of your duties, your goals in those capacities, tell me about your background, how you came to live in Iowa. I understand you're originally from New Hampshire.
Well, first of all, let me make a correction. I used to be the, I at one time was the director of the Freedom Foundation here in Iowa, but I'm no longer. I am now the executive director of the Council on American-Hispanic Relations Iowa chapter. And yes, I was raised in New Hampshire primarily my formative years, but I'm from the East Coast up and down. My dad was in the military. And what brought me to Iowa was my husband's job. Frankly, before we came here, I didn't know a lot about the state. I had seen a special on the mosque in Cedar Rapids on a public television show, and it intrigued us, but we didn't pay too much attention to it. And when we came, we found that we had relatives here. So it turned out to be a good community to move to, and we've raised our children here, and we love it.
Mm-hmm. Part of your challenges you face in your work as director is to take on new immigrants and do what? To raise their awareness about living in Iowa, living in the United States?
Basically, when they come here, a lot of them are refugees, and they're basically just dumped. They're given a few weeks or a couple of months of support, and then they're told you're on your own. Many of them have never even seen a toilet. And what we do is help them navigate through the minutiae of society, you know, where to get a job, how to get a rental agreement. If they have problems in their job, a lot of the women wear the traditional dress of the hijab and the niqab and whatnot, and we help them through that if they have problems in society. The men generally don't understand why they have to work alongside women, and you know there are problems there. And what we do is we help guide them, and then if they come across an obstacle, we help them get around that obstacle, and we also help them to become citizens. And that's the most important part, because they can become productive citizens by knowing what and how to do things. So it's our job, and then our other job is the advocacy part of it. And that is, you know, getting them assimilated, basically. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the legal issues involved with discrimination and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Do they face discrimination, prejudices when they arrive simply because they can be identified perhaps as Muslim?
A lot of them do. And it comes down to ignorance. Ignorance, not knowing the culture. And, like, I have one client whose prayer rug was stolen from him repeatedly at work. And they didn't. The people that he works with don't understand the obligation of a Muslim to pray five times a day. And using the rug just makes the area where he prays clean. And they did it partly as a joke and partly because they didn't understand. They did not understand what a Muslim is and what our obligations are as far as religious obligations to our faith. And that's basically where it stems from, is ignorance of our faith.
Miriam Amer, I'd ask you to stand by, too. Tremendous that you're with us this afternoon. I want to introduce Lisa Killinger, Outreach Coordinator for the Muslim Community of the Quad Cities. Good afternoon to you, Lisa.
My pleasure to be here.
Now, you are you a native Iowan?
I am a native Iowan.
You converted to Islam. Tell us when and why that happened.
Well, I've been Muslim 32 years today, actually.
Congratulations.
This is my birthday, the first day of the fasting month of Ramadan. It's my birthday in Islam. So I embraced Islam in 1979 as a college student. I was away from home for the first time and studying about world religions, just out of interest, informally, and ended up meeting some Muslim students who ate in a special cafeteria where I ate, and they asked what I believed and what I described to them about my beliefs. They just shrugged and said, oh, she's Muslim. I didn't know anything about Islam. And in fact, on that ill-fated day, I asked them, are you the ones that worship cows? I had no idea. I missed that chapter in social studies class. So I couldn't have been farther off. But I asked for books and learned.
Yeah. Why did Islam connect with you where Christianity, the predominant religion in this country and in Iowa, did not?
I was raised as a Christian and actually was very active in the Christian faith. I was teaching Sunday school when I ended up embracing Islam. But I was always troubled by the concept of the Trinity. I loved dearly biblical teachings, and I had nothing against my faith, but I struggled about the concept of Trinity. And when I learned about the simple message of Islam, that there's one God who created the world and sent a series of messengers, all of whom are equally and all of whom basically had the same message, be good to others and be good to each other and worship one God and be good to each other. That resonated with me, and the more I read about Islam, the more I felt that that was the faith that was appropriate for me.
Lisa Killinger, I wonder if you don't mind me asking, if I saw you on the street, we met on the street, we have not met before, but would your appearance tell me that you are Muslim?
Well, now it would, because I wear a scarf, but I'm blonde and blue-eyed and as white as can be, almost transparent. So I think that I wouldn't maybe, people wouldn't think first when they see me that, oh, she must be Muslim. No, not at all. They think maybe I'm a cancer survivor because I'm wearing a scarf. They would have all sorts of other thoughts, but maybe not that I'm Muslim because I look pretty typical Midwestern, Eastern European background American.
When people learn that you are a convert to Muslim, Islam, what are people generally most curious about?
Well, I think that one of the things is I'm an educated woman. I'm a doctor and a professor here at the college in Davenport. And I think some people ask me the question, you know, why would somebody who's an educated woman ever want to be a part of a faith, and in their words, that's so oppressive to women? And then this kind of question has been asked me since 1979. So here, 32 years later, I have a lot of practice in sort of going through and breaking down misconceptions about women in Islam. And I actually enjoy doing it. I've spoken, you know, a thousand times at least over the past 30 or so years.
And in a nutshell, what is your answer to that commonly asked question about women and Islam?
Well, women had the rights to vote, to own property, to inherit, to work outside the home, to keep their own income, to have education, and a laundry list of other rights long, long, long before women in this country got them. And it's a very, very liberated faith for women.
Okay. We want to explore that further in a little while. We're coming up to the end of our first half hour, and I want to make sure that we introduce one of our final guests, Frederic Boudouani. He is an Algerian and the proprietor of Shara's Algerian-American Restaurant and Bar in Alcater, Iowa. And if you are listening to Rob Dillard's series this week, one of the features focused on Frederic Boudouani and his restaurant. Welcome to our studios, Frederic.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Now tell us again, remind us for those who didn't catch Rob's piece, you are the only Muslim living in Alcater. How did that come to be?
First of all, thanks for having me, and assalamu alaikum. And I would like to wish Ramadan Mubarak to all those fasting today. Also, happy birthday to Lisa. That's kind of cool to have your birthday match up with Ramadan.
Thank
it's
you.
Kind of a double party in one. But no... My journey to Alcater is really interesting. Like many, I always say that as Muslims, our past always kind of, the conversation always leads us back to September 11th, to our recent history. And I always say that September 11th was a horrific event in the history of humankind. But if you had the connection to that part of the world, it was a million times worse, because all of a sudden you're in the midst of this gigantic geopolitical conflict that you don't necessarily comprehend. You are in a way being blamed for it. It was certainly not the faith nor the values that my father taught me about my faith. So in my way of making sense of that horrific event, I decided to research the history of Islam in the United States. And to my great surprise, that led me to Iowa, to the Modern Mosque of America, the first mosque in the nation. Digging into that a little further, it said, well, Iowa is really unique in a sense because it's not only home to the first mosque in the nation, but it's the only state in the Union that has a town named after an Arab Muslim. And I would never forget finding out who the Arab Muslim was, because he was Alcater. The town of Alcater is named after Emir Abdel Qader, who is sort of like, in a nutshell, the George Washington of Algeria. He fought for the freedom of his country from the French in the mid-1800s, and later on in life kind of gave up politics and became this very well-respected figure, admired by many.
And many, including pioneers who settled Iowa.
Well, not only pioneers. I mean, just a little point there. There is a museum dedicated to him in Algiers, and there is a pair of pistols that were sent to him by Abraham Lincoln in recognition for his moral character and his deeds. Queen Victoria recognized him. When he passed away, the New York Times hailed him as one of his greatest in the time, and you can check it out on the archives of New York Times on the front page, which is kind of humbling and interesting. But to the great credit of Iowans, I think one of the most fascinating part about the story of Al-Qaeda, Iowa, is that to me and to many Muslims, Emir Abdelkader is not a stranger. But what's fascinating about the story is that in the mid-1800s, I have to believe that if you found in a town, that's got to be very precious to you. Yet these people had the great open-mindedness to name it after somebody from the other part of the world. They didn't share his faith. They didn't share his language. They didn't share his religion. Yet they went ahead and did it. And it's been a great story, a sister city program with Mascara in Algeria for the past 25 years, and a bridge building between cultures, if you will.
Frederic Boudwani, one of our guests this day on Iowa Public Radio's The Exchange. Chris is joining us by phone. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Chris, I see on my screen that you are from Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I'm from Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. Lived there my whole life.
What did you want to add here?
Yeah. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Yeah, we have just about a minute before we have to take a break. You wanted to make a comment.
Oh, well, I'd like to, comment on the Abdelkader aspect of it. There was a great book that came out in 2008 called Commander of the Faithful by John W. Kaiser. And he got an assist from Ed Olson, who was the mayor of Al-Qaeda when I was, in high school. And it's a great book. It's, he fought the French during the revolution, and the way he used his Muslim faith to treat prisoners of war with respect, and he was greatly respected even by the French after he inevitably lost and was under house arrest there in France.
Sounds like a great book to read. That title again, Chris?
Commander of the Faithful.
Okay, very good. Chris joining us by phone. We have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with our guests on this Monday, August 1st, the first day of Ramadan, the ninth month of the Islamic calendar, a month when Muslims in the Middle East and around the world gather together to fast, pray, connect with family, friends, and reevaluate their lives in the light of Islamic guidance. We're looking at the Islamic community here in Iowa with several Muslim guests. Mahmoud Hamid, he is an associate professor of politics at Drake University. You've heard him, of course, on Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. And also Miriam Amer, Lisa Killinger, and Frederic Boudwani, all here. And we want to hear from you when we come back after a short break. Are you a Muslim living in Iowa? Tell us your story this hour. Or do you just have a question about Islam? Perhaps you've heard something in the media about the faith and you'd like to have it cleared up. We have the people to do that right here. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more Being Muslim in Iowa, our focus this hour on The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. A majority of Americans say they know very little about the major world religion, Islam, even though it's followed by 1.5 billion people around the globe. That's five times the number of people who live in the United States. This hour, we're looking at being Muslim in Iowa. What is that experience like? We have, as our guests, a number of Muslim Iowans who are giving us various perspectives on answering that question. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you're a Muslim living in Iowa. You can tell us your story, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you are curious and have a question about Islam, something you've heard in the news and want to find out more about. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Give us a tweet at IPR Talk. Joining us, Mahmoud Hamid, Associate Professor of Politics at Drake University, Miriam Amer. Miriam is Executive Director of the Council on Islamic Relations, the Iowa chapter, Lisa Killinger, Outreach Coordinator for the Muslim Community of the Quad Cities, and Frederic Boudouani, the proprietor of Shera's, Algerian American Restaurant and Bar in El Cater. And those are our guests. I would like to just, since we have a all of our phone lines are full. Lots of comments and questions. Let's just try to field as many of those and weave in some of your other comments as well. First of all, to Craig in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Craig. Welcome to our program.
Hi. I'd just like to ask your guests if somehow, some way, the Muslim community could vote out the United States Constitution, would your guests rather live under Sharia law than the U.S. Constitution?
Okay, Craig, very good. Sharia law, of course, a lot in the news lately. Mahmoud Hamid, can I toss that one to you? Tell us what Sharia law is and what you've been seeing in the media, how that matches up with reality.
Sharia law is the general principles that cover the life of Muslims and how they should conduct their business and how they navigate through life. And the general principles are not very different from the general principles of other religions. So, for example, equality among ethnic groups. The Prophet, peace be upon him, said there is no difference between an Arab and non-Arab, or there is no difference between a man and a woman. There is also equality before the law, that everyone is entitled to the same treatment. He also stated rightly that if Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad, would stolen something, I would have punished her. And rights and liberties for minorities, which are all components of a democratic practice. Other than the general principles, Sharia is silent on many issues. And the Prophet, again, said when he was asked about other things, he said, you know better about your life, because he knew rightly that life changes. And other than general principles that cover the main umbrella, everything should be adjusted to our conditions.
Mahmoud, what about the concern that Craig has that Sharia law would somehow subjugate the U.S. Constitution, the laws of our land?
Sharia law will never do that, first of all, because Muslims are the minority. Sharia only can be enforced in a Muslim-majority state. I have not heard any reliable call for that. I have never heard the discussion among my friends and family and co-workers about even a demand or request for that. So it's just unrealistic.
Mm-hmm. Miriam, Mayor, can I turn to you for your reaction to that question?
Sure. You know, first consideration is that this Sharia law thing is being used as a scare tactic. As the professor said, that it is not applicable. In paraphrasing him, it is not applicable to non-Muslims. It's a guidance for Muslim life. There have been a few cases in the United States where some matters of divorce and things like that were it was settled under an Islamic practice, and it was upheld by the American courts. The Constitution of the United States is the Constitution of the land. A Muslim is told to live under the law of the land and to be a good citizen. So it's something that it's totally it has nothing to do with Muslims and the Constitution of the United States, other than we should be good citizens and follow the Constitution. There are many, many commonalities, so it's not very far afield. So you're not asking something that's practical. If you're asking for someone, you know, to overthrow the Constitution of the United States and put in Sharia law, what is this? We are less than 1% of the population. How would that be possible, first of all? Second of all, why would it be practical? Thirdly, it's a scare tactic.
Okay, Frederic Boudouani, you wanted to get in on this question before we move on.
Yeah, I absolutely wanted to say a quick thing. I want to put your caller at ease. Most of the time I carry the Constitution of the United States on me. I think it's one of the most beautiful document that was ever written. I hold it in a very special plate. I respect it, and if I have to, I will defend it with my life. We are Muslims, but we are American above all.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much, Craig in Cedar Rapids. Thank you very much. Let's go to Laura in Des Moines. Thank you for calling 1-866-780-9100. Laura, what's on your mind in this conversation?
I was curious, and I'm glad that one of your people in your group mentioned that women have rights according to the Quran, and I noticed that in the quotes that the person just made. But what do regimes and governments that claim to be following the Quran, what part of the Quran do they quote when they take away women's rights or punish them for practicing free rights like education and that sort of thing?
Lisa Killinger, can I turn to you for an answer to that question?
Absolutely. I think that education is key here. When Muslims know their rights, especially Muslim women, then they can't be subjugated. They will demand their rights. And when if Muslim leaders were not ignorant of their faith, they would be able to at least draw from Islamic guidance. But I certainly can't speak to the cultural clutter of some place like Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan, where the Taliban has encouraged practices that are as far away from Islam as one can imagine, because they've discouraged women from being educated when education is a requirement of all Muslim women. So it's just, there are crazy things happening that I can't answer for, but certainly Islam offers a lot of guidance and certainly many rights for women.
Can I jump in?
Yes, go ahead.
Mahmoud,
yes.
What interesting fact about the life of the Prophet, which Muslims try to imitate, is that Muhammad, when he was working actually for his first wife, Khadija was a grand merchant. She was a very successful businesswoman. That was 1,500 years ago, and Muhammad got to know her because he was working for her. So Muslim women have enjoyed rights and liberties way before those rights and liberties have been secured in the Western world. Muslim women have, 1,500 years ago when Islam came, have financial status, were able to be part of the society. In one great moment, Khalifa Omar, who was the second Khalifa after the Prophet, tried to basically limit the amount of dowry that people give in order to get married, because it became such an instrumental number, mm-hmm. and people were not able to get married. And there is a woman who stood up and basically shouted, "You don't have the right to do that." And he said, "I am wrong, and this lady is correct. You mentioned when you introduced me that I had my undergraduate degree in Cairo University, and back in my School of Economics and Political Science, 70% of the faculty are female, including the dean and the associate dean, two of the associate deans. The practice, Muslim societies like Pakistan and Bangladesh had prime ministers, female prime ministers, even before Britain and other countries.
Which criticisms of the treatment of women in Muslim societies do you agree with? Because there's certainly plenty of criticisms for women not being treated as equal members of societies around the world. Where can you point to that you would say that is not in accordance with Islamic law?
Absolutely. It's a misunderstanding of Islam. It's a misunderstanding of the principles of our religion. What I lived in Saudi Arabia because my dad was working there, and their understanding of Islam is very, very limited. There is nothing in Quran, and I read Quran, I read Hadith, and I read the history of the Prophet and his companions that denies Muslim women the right to work or denies Muslim women the right to drive. Those are just cultural misconceptions that being deluded with the principles of religion, and it's mainly for political purposes. You don't see that in many, many Muslim societies.
Mahmoud Hamid of Drake University, a lot to talk about there. I feel we're moving along when we could delve on any one point for a much longer time. Laura, thank you for that question from Des Moines.
Thank you.
And let's talk to John in Waterloo. John, are you still there? Hi, John. Welcome to the exchange. You're on the air. John, are you there? Evidently not. John, call back. Kathy in LeClaire. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, this is Kathy Bochum from LeClaire, and I would just like to speak to the interfaith dialogue that we've had going on here for a number of years. As a non-Muslim, I have learned so much from spending time with people like Lisa Killinger and other Muslims and other Christians and Jews and Buddhists and across the gamut. But I think that ignorance is really the thing we're talking about here, that just as Christianity can be misused, for instance, some people feel like that calls for the subjugation of women to their husbands. You know, it's all cultural. It's not necessarily what's in the teachings that's the problem. And I think that what's most important is for us all to realize and recognize that Muslim Americans are Americans. They are just like us. We are all the same, though we might practice different faiths. We all want the same things from life. And the core values at the root of all of our faiths is the same. But the more we get to know each other and spend time together and break bread together, the more we can break down these stereotypes, these fears, these things that people hear about and read about that they assume to be the truth about everyone who practices Islam.
Kathy from LeClaire, thank you for joining our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Miriam Amer, let me talk to you a moment because you serve, I understand, on the board of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union. What specifically are the chief challenges that Muslims in Iowa face in terms of civil liberties?
Well, let me clarify. First of all, I'm a past board member of the Civil Liberties Union, and we face the same kind of problems that most minorities, that every minority that has come to this country has faced. First of all, you have, you know, people who don't like you because of your skin color, and maybe because of your religion, maybe because of your accent. It doesn't matter. We've all nationalities, all races, all religions have been through this, and this happens to be our turn. We're Americans. My family's been here for seven generations. And I was recently on a radio show in Des Moines where I was told that I didn't know what being an American is by somebody who just became an American a few years ago. Now, the thing is, we're here. We're going to stay here. We're part of the fabric of this nation, and we are going to continue to be the fabric of this nation. And we are working alongside non-Muslims, and we are peaceful. We cannot define our entire faith by the actions of a handful. That's first of all, an illegitimate cause and reason. And the Muslims who are here now face the same problems that the Hispanics, you know, and the blacks face, and anyone else who's a minority. And, you know, we have to come across and prove, why would we have to prove this? Second of all, you know, we're here, we're Americans. Let's all forget the past and move forward.
This is Lisa. Could I add a comment as well, Miriam?
Sure. Lisa Killinger, go ahead, yes.
I've had the experience of going from being I'm Caucasian, so I was in a majority in this country, and then suddenly because I embraced Islam, I became a minority, and it was very, very strange. And there have been many experiences I've had along the way of, having fears or having concerns or doubts, because I looked a little different because I wore a scarf, and I'm still the same person I always was. It's very odd to become a minority.
Mm-hmm. Frederick Boudwani, your thoughts?
Honestly, I think that throughout our history, and unfortunately, there was always somebody at the bottom of the totem pole. Throughout our history, it was the Irish people and the Italians and the African Americans, and it seems like now it's our turn. And if that's the way for us to pay our dues, then so be it. But we are Americans.
Let's go to James in West Des Moines. James, welcome to The Exchange.
Hello. I had a question for your guest, mainly about what the views of homosexuality are in Islam. Does it run the gamut? Is there a single uniform idea of what homosexuality is and what to do about it?
Okay, James, great question. Let's go to Mahmoud Hamid of Drake University. The homosexuality in Islam, is that all over the board as far as interpretations, or is that unified there?
As far as I understand it, Muslims believe marriage to be between a man and a woman. Homosexuality is not embraced by Islam.
Mm-hmm. In fact, in some countries, in Iran, wasn't it the Iranian president who said that homosexuality did not exist in his country?
He would like to believe it does not exist. As an academic, I cannot say for sure that is correct.
And yet there are gay people who are Muslim in America. There's conferences and various things. So to say that the Muslim community is monolithic on this idea or this concept would be certainly scholars have an agreement about homosexuality, but the range of people that are Muslims have a broad range of ideas.
Frederick, yeah.
We are a fabric. We are a mosaic like any other fabric in this country. There is queer Muslims the same way as there is queers in any other ethnic group. The same way we don't think of the Baptist the Baptist Church of Phelps as the representative of Christianity, we shouldn't think of Ahmadinejad as the representative of Muslims and Islam.
Gary is joining us from Cedar Rapids. Gary, welcome to the exchange. Just a few more minutes. So, what is on your mind?
Thank you. I was just curious if women have the same equal rights. In some countries over there, the women are trying to fight to be able to drive a car. So, mm-hmm. And there's other issues that they kind of suppress them.
Okay, a little further explanation for Gary. Mahmoud Hamid, you said you lived in Saudi Arabia, and I think that is one of the countries where women are not allowed to drive. A little more explanation for Gary. How could that be if it's supposed equal rights for women and men?
That is because of the fabric of the Saudi state. The Saudi state was built on on an alliance between a very traditionalist, conservative, religious group, the Wahhabis, and the Saudi family, Saudi royal family. So part of the deal is that the Saudi royal family, Saudi state, embraced a very, very strict conservative understanding of Islam. And that is why you see these kind of rules. It does not exist even across the border in Bahrain, in Emirates, in Qatar, or even in Yemen. So this is the only state, as far as I know, in the Islamic Islamic majority countries that prevent women from driving. You have 40 countries that are Muslim. There's a sizable number of Muslims. Each of them allow Muslim women to drive or allow female to drive.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is Lisa. Could I add one comment to just make it easier on listeners?
Sure, Lisa.
Islam doesn't allow kings. We elect leaders on the basis of their moral character and their knowledge. So if there's a country that has run by a king, you can pretty much bet that they've strayed far, far from Islam, and they're not led in any Islamic way whatsoever.
Lisa Killinger, thank you very much. We have just a couple minutes left. I would like to get your concluding comments to as many of our guests as we can get to, and starting with Frederick Boudwani of El Cater, proprietor of a restaurant there. I understand your restaurant, you see the mission of your restaurant as something more than food, but raising awareness about Islam in the United States and its traditions.
Well, it's funny. It's interesting how that developed. We started the restaurant as a business, as a way for us to make a living. And the more we went along, the more it turned into sort of a cultural destination. People would come not just for the culinary satisfaction, but seeking the knowledge and what is this strange place from around the world that there is a town named after it in the heartland. So that's sort of the mission. And I always like to emphasize to people that if we're speaking about the three monotheic faiths, whether it's Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, they have all the same roots. And I'd like to emphasize what unites us. Unfortunately, generally people tend to focus on the things that separate us. There is a lot more things that unite us. I mean, I was reading about it this morning, and to my great surprise, I discovered that Jesus is mentioned more than the Prophet Muhammad in the Quran. The Virgin Mary has a whole chapter that's dedicated to her in the Quran. She's one of the most revered women in the Muslim faith.
Miriam Amer, our time is running short, but I wonder if you had a concluding remark briefly.
Yeah, you know, in Iowa, we're very welcomed here. The people of Iowa are open-hearted, and they are very welcoming to anyone who comes here. Doesn't matter if you're Muslim or if you're a Buddhist or Hindu. It doesn't matter. The people of Iowa are good people, and people of the United States are good people. And we're glad to be part of this society. We're happy to be Americans. This is the country, the only one in the world, where we have the rights that we have. And it's a very special country, and we will all defend it to to the constitutional right down the line. I mean, the Constitution, the American people, there are Muslims that are in the military. My dad was in the military. My brother, my uncle, my cousins. One of my cousins died in the military. My great-grandfather was a rider with Teddy Roosevelt. And, you know, to be told that we don't belong here, they don't know their history. Anyone who says that and anyone who pounds on Sharia law doesn't know what they're talking about. Muslims have been here for hundreds of years, and we're not going anywhere. We were your cousins, we're your friends, we're your neighbors.
Okay.
And, you know, we'd like to be part of the society and accept it.
Miriam Amer, thank you very much. Executive Director of the Council of Islamic Relations, Iowa Chapter. Lisa Killinger, thank you very much. Frederick Boudwani, proprietor of Shara's Algerian-American Restaurant and Bar in El Cater. And, of course, Mahmoud Hamid, Associate Professor of Politics at Drake University. Fascinating, fascinating hour. Thank you all for joining us and, of course, our listeners for chipping in comments and questions. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance from Lindsay Moon today. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio available at iowapublicradio.org. In Des Moines, help from Emily Boyer. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.